Today on Maine Calling, Maine's iconic moose. This Saturday, sportsmen and women hoping for moose hunting permits will take part in Maine's annual moose lottery. The moose hunting season begins on September 28th. There are plenty of moose in Maine. In fact, more moose live here than any other state in the lower 48. But they face serious threats, especially the devastating spread of winter ticks. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, our guest is Maine's moose expert, wildlife biologist Lee Cantor, with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. For more than two decades, Cantor has focused on moose and only moose. He will discuss what he has learned about this remarkable Goliath and how he hopes to protect moose for ages to come. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In Maine, moose are a big draw for tourists and hunters alike. But this enormous creature is under attack from the tiny winter tick, as well as other threats. Today, we will talk with leading moose expert Lee Cantor to learn about ways that the state is managing and protecting Maine's moose population. Lee Cantor is the state's moose biologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. In 2019, he was awarded the Distinguished Moose Biologist Award at the North American Moose Conference. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you ever seen a moose in the wild? Do you have questions about this year's hunt? Do you have questions about their biology? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Lee, welcome back to Maine Calling. And I learned this morning that we are the only state with a dedicated moose biologist. How did that happen? I mean, did like 2.5 decades ago, somebody say, wait a minute, these need just somebody to focus all of their time on this?
You know, it's amazing how much that statement has gotten traction and gotten me so much lip from my fellow moose biologists in North America. there are other moose biologists in North America for sure. I think what's unique about Maine is that that's all I do. And we're really very fortunate in Maine with the Department of Inland Fish and Wildlife because we have species specialists that cover everything from freshwater mussels and butterflies to moose. I think what happened with that statement is that it got a little misconstrued because other moose biologists may have other job duties and responsibilities. So it came off very interesting, but I've got a lot of ribbing, so it's got a lot of mileage.
Oh, well, I wasn't meaning to rib you. I was just thinking, I know that Alaska has even more moose than Maine, and one would think that maybe there'd be a whole team up there. But
they do have a team for sure, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about Maine's moose population. So many people who care about moose know about the winter tick and have probably seen the pictures and videos, and they're just heartbreaking. This past winter was really cold. Did that help? Did that help moose survive? Did winter ticks die?
Well, unfortunately, no, because the unique aspect of winter tick is that they spend the majority of their life cycle on the moose over wintertime, which is likely why they got the name winter tick. It's not a deer tick. It's not a dog tick. It's its own species. And it gets on the moose around September and lives on the moose. So it doesn't care whether it's a very mild, warm winter or a very cold winter. It's living off the blood of that moose, taking three different meals during its three life cycles on the moose, drops off in May by the time they shed out their coat and does quite a bit of damage, especially on the small moose.
So what's the update this year? What did you find when you went out surveying the moose population?
Unfortunately, it's not good news at all, because if you recall, in 2025, when these ticks are basically laying dormant as egg masses over the summertime, towards the end of the summer, we had really droughty conditions in a lot of tick areas in northern Maine and north central Maine. And we thought the droughty conditions might help dry out the egg sacs, because that's known to happen. So we were hoping for a reduction in the number of winter ticks that emerge in the fall and get on moose. And actually what happened is that we had just as many winter ticks getting on moose as the previous year. And we saw that in a very high mortality rate of the calves trying to get to their first birthday. So when I talk about calves, I'm not talking about ones that are born right now in May and June, but I'm talking about calves that are entering their first winter. They're 400-pound animals. And if they have a heavy tick load and they have a little bit less weight carried on them, they can succumb to it. And we lost 72% of my collared calves by this May, this past year. So it was a pretty bad year for winter tick.
Oh, boy, that is discouraging. 72% of your collared calves, which you extrapolate out is probably about 72% of the calves in the population.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily, it's probably a worst case scenario, but yeah, we take it as being representative of the core moose range, which is essentially all of our commercial forest lands. And there may be some spots that are hot spots and some spots not as bad, but you know, if you want to look at it conservatively, we would say that that's fairly representative.
We've been talking about this for years now, more than a decade, correct? So what does that mean for Maine's moose population? What I read is that you all estimate about 60,000 moose in Maine. Is that number still accurate, or are the numbers declining?
Well, we haven't looked at the total population since 2012 doing aerial surveys, but the population has been on decline. And the thing that's challenging about that, it's really a loaded question, because we're talking about looking at a moose population at the turn of the century, 1999 to 2000. That was at a high point. And really an unnatural state. Moose across the North American moose range live at very low densities. They're not like deer. Just because of their massive size, they require a lot of area, because they have to take in so much food on a daily basis. So they have to be spaced far apart. And of course, Maine is a great place for moose because of the commercial forest lands. It creates a lot of food for them. But, you know, when you have a dense population, the more dense it becomes, they become susceptible to other things. That is, they can get low productivity when food goes in decline, or they can get diseases or parasites that are much higher because they're at higher densities. And so, you know, over the last 13 years of the research that we've done in the state, we've seen a decline. We still have moose populations that are fairly moderate levels compared to other states, because we started at such a high point. And when I say start, I mean when we started to see winter ticks really afflict moose in the early 2000s, not every year is a severe tick year. And so if you have a year, for instance, in I think it was 2024, we had a very high survival year. And so if you have a high survival year of overwintering calves and you have increased reproduction of moose, your population goes back up a little bit, and then the next year goes back down. So it's kind of a wave that's happened.
So it's not the goal to have necessarily a large moose population. The goal is to figure out the ideal moose population for the ecosystem.
It's certainly not a goal anymore to have as many moose as you can, because, you know, honestly, you know, what it's doing to calves is a very ugly thing. I mean, I think people need to think of the winter tick as having a predator on the landscape. You know, so we know that in places like Alaska and in parts of Canada where you have wolves and you have bears, those animals can take up to 80% of the new crop of calves going into their first year, because, of course, a smaller animal is more vulnerable to predation. Well, winter tick is exerting the same type of force on the population, where before that animal gets to be a year old, in some years we lose a lot of those animals. And so what biologists call recruitment, when an animal gets to an age where its survival rates are more equal to an adult, it doesn't happen to our moose until they're well past a year old. And so that is a real challenge for us.
What is being done? What are you trying to combat the winter tick? Is there anything that can be done?
Well, so this, of course, brings out a lot of passion and compassion in people all across the world. In fact, I recently got a call from a Montana rancher with a solution. I got another call this last week from a guy with Alaska with a solution. And it's very encouraging that that people are interested and want to find a solution. The problem is that we're dealing with a wild animal that, as an individual, ranges across 10 to 12 square miles in the North Maine woods. And so people have asked us about, well, why don't you treat the animal, like you would your pet? And we've talked about this before, which is, well, we don't have control over any individual moose, right? I mean, we don't, or the larger scale. I mean, we capture moose and put a collar on it, but if you capture 70 moose and you have tens of thousands of moose on the landscape, it's not going to change anything to treat those moose. So that's problematic right there because of the scope and scale of that. Then people ask, well, why don't you spray the woods? Well, 90% of the Maine woods is privately owned. And anything that would try to kill a tick, you can imagine how difficult it is to kill ticks, is going to be harmful for the environment. So the solution there is trying to find something biological that doesn't have some other effect that's going to harm other insects, going to harm water or soil or plants or anything else. And that's just not out there. And so the department has been looking at doing a lot of different things for the last 13 years, which obviously includes our research aspect to understand what the problem is and how to try to solve that problem. We just concluded a 5-year research project, which was essentially an adaptive unit where we tried to increase a harvest of cows to try to bring the population down to see if we can break the tick cycle. And now we're looking at a next phase of looking at forest management and implications for trying to disperse moose on the landscape more. So we're trying to tackle a problem that's at the landscape level that makes it all the more of a challenge, and also trying to understand the dynamics of winter tick, which is so complicated.
Is this, first I wanted to ask you, you just said that you completed the project with the experiment with the adaptive hunt with the cows. Did that have an impact? I mean, what are your conclusions?
Well, so we did that over 5 years. We increased the harvest. We harvested more cows. But at this point, I'm working on a final report right now. We didn't see any changes, and part of that tells you that what drives the population of moose and drives the system is the survival of overwinter calves and reproduction of moose, which is all based on what the ticks are doing. And so again, we had 1 year in that 5 years where we had excellent survival of calves. We only lost 8% of the calves that year, and so the population goes up. And then the next year we have a huge mortality and a die-off, and then we lose a bunch of moose. And so over the course of 5 years, in some sense, it's not a long enough time to determine that. But we also had lots of sideboards and restrictions for our harvest, which is we were using a general hunt framework. We weren't doing things too terribly different than what we normally do. And cow moose can be a challenge to hunt, especially in the late part of the season.
Oh, yeah. So the second part of my question was, how much does the changing climate impact the moose population? How much is it a part of this, not just figuring out what to do about the winter tick, but also other threats to moose?
Well, it seems to be a pretty significant part because what we know, and there's been so much work done on winter ticks, but I think because it lives for a year and it's a one host life cycle, there's lots of complexities there. And again, like having coming through this drought year and being so discouraged by the fact that the ticks had high survival was really a tough pill to swallow. But normally, what we see is that when fall weather comes in early, that literally knocks the ticks down off of the bushes and prevents moose from accumulating these tens of thousands of ticks on them. So if they have less ticks on them in a given winter and their weights are decent, they have a higher ability to survive. But when we get these winters that are, especially in the fall, don't start until really late, that becomes a problem. So for us, you know, like I was saying to you before, we've do our moose captures in January in northern Maine. And over the 13 years, the last 5 to 10 years, I mean, we've gone up there where we've had very little snow on the ground. You know, the first week of January, there's like an inch of snow on the ground in northern Maine. And that's problematic because the longer fall is open and there's no really extreme cold and deep snow, the longer those ticks have to get on moose and the more ticks are on the moose.
You know, Lee, you mentioned the tagged calves. I know that you do tag moose. How do you do that? And then outside of tagging, how do you keep track of them? It involves all sorts of vehicles, doesn't it? From snowmobiles to airplanes.
Yeah. So, you know, we were fortunate enough back in 2014 to work with our friends over in New Hampshire at Fish and Game, University of New Hampshire. And we collaborated on a study starting back then that ran for 7 years. And we put GPS collars on these moose and put ear tags in them, collect blood, fecals, and weigh the calves during January. And this last January was our 13th year of doing that in across three different studies areas. We put collars on over 1,000 moose. The majority of that work's done where we contract a helicopter from the pilot's actually, and the company's actually from New Zealand, but they have a base in Wyoming. And so they come in for a week and they use what's called a net gun, where it's shot out of a modified 308 rifle, and it's got a net in a plastic cone with four weights on the corners. And when it gets shot at the moose, that net spreads out very wide and tangles the moose. They immediately land the helicopter, get out of the helicopter, get the moose on the ground, put hobbles on it in a blindfold, and then the moose is calm and they're able to work it up, put on the collar, put on the ear tags, etc., and send it on its way. In fact, I guess it was last year, we put out a film that covers all of this, and it's called Guardian of the Giants, and it's on a website called Hunting ME, which is one word. It's Hunting ME is a guy named John Altman and his son, and they do all kinds of work in wildlife management, and they do a lot of film work as well, and they came to the department. And they wanted to bridge that gap to show people and talk about what does the department actually do for research and management on moose. And of course, the best way to do that is visually, for people to actually see it. And so John and his folks were all embedded with us. They got up in the helicopter with us. They went out on the ground on snowmobiles and ATVs for necropsies. They went to the moose lottery. They went to the wildlife park when I was talking about moose. They did it all, followed me around for a year, and came out with this film that's about 35 minutes long that really shows from our point of view how we're operating in the field during some interesting weather times. So that was quite a thing.
Well, Guardians of the Giants, I'll be sure and find that and attach a link in our Maine Calling newsletter that goes out every Friday. Lee, I want to ask you more fun facts about moose, but we do need to take a break. This is Maine Calling. We are talking to the Maine State moose biologist, Lee Cantor. What are your questions? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Maine is famous for having more moose than any other of the lower 48 states. But this iconic species is being threatened by relentless winter ticks. Today, to talk about Maine's moose population is Maine's moose biologist, Lee Cantor. What are your questions? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, or email address talk@mainepublic.org. So, Lee, before we get to listener questions, I just want to go through some fun facts about moose. First of all, how much do they weigh?
Well, I mean, live weight. I was telling you before that when we capture a calf that's 8 months old in January, it's already 400 pounds. And I think that's amazing because a calf born in May weighs 35 pounds. So you picture an animal that's going from 35 pounds to 400 pounds in essentially 8 months. That's pretty impressive. Of course, we know that an adult bull moose being the largest, we're talking 1,300 pounds live weight. So just a tremendous sized animal and incredible when you think about living on a diet of leafy material and woody browse like they do, right?
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, I think the iconic picture that we all have in our mind's eye of a moose is like sort of like knee deep in a pond or a lake or even belly deep and just munching away at water plants. Is that most of their diet, or do they eat other things as well?
Well, I mean, the aquatic part is a huge thing in Maine during the summertime. And it's a huge thing in Maine because just the geography of our state and the availability of lakes and ponds and brooks and wetlands and backwater, you name it. And aquatic plants have a high sodium content. And so moose can go into a body of water and just like you said, exactly. And I've witnessed this many, many times. Where I see just the hump of an animal going back and forth in the water, and you're like, what is going on? It's like a moving rock. And then all of a sudden, that head comes out of the water, and all the water pours off of it. Really an impressive animal to see that in the wild.
Okay, so to go from 30 pounds to 400 pounds in a matter of months,
Yeah.
how much do they eat?
Well, so of course, the newborn in May for the month. For May and into June, into July, has both colostrum and milk from the mother, which is really fatty, really rich. So there's a lot of weight gain as it takes off from birth. But then by the end of the summer, it's weaned. So now it's starting to eat what mom's eating. So it's eating, leafy matter, stripping maple trees, birch, willow, cherry, all those type of things. So that's just an amazing thing that they. Just based on that diet alone, can reach such a large size in such a short order.
That's interesting you talk about them stripping the bark because I learned that the word moose comes from, well, tell us about the word because it has to do with that behavior.
Right. So they think of moose as an Algonquin term, eater of twigs, basically. But yeah. It strips both by using its mouth to strip the leaves off of a branch, but it also does what we call barking, which is it takes its lower incisors and rakes up on a tree that's probably the size of my hand. And they like to do red maples as their favorite tree. And it's very interesting because deer will do that on hemlock. And they always, biologists like to call that they're in like a starvation mode. Moose don't do that because they're starving. Moose do that because there's some sugars in the sap there, but they can eat that red maple. They like to peel up that bark for whatever reason. But what's amazing is when you look at the marks on a tree, the scars from the tree from a moose, you think it starts to make your teeth ache when you think about that, right? That, well, a moose can do that with its lower incisors. Not something I want to try, but yeah, one of their
Well,
favorites.
it is tourist season, so I'm assuming that there are some people from out of state listening right now. What's your advice, Lee, if somebody encounters a moose?
For encountering a moose, well, I mean, it's a little bit of a keep your distance, right? It's we appreciate when all people viewing wildlife keep their distance. And moose are known. I think a lot of people think of moose as being very docile. I would say that moose can be very tolerant, sometimes too tolerant. And then a moose can run as fast as 35 miles per hour. So it can be a very fast animal, and just based on its sheer size, it's something that people just need to give wide berth to. And of course, I always tell people that's why they have binoculars, right? Because you can get plenty of view with your binoculars and with your phones and all that when you see a moose. But give it its space and give it plenty of room to walk off in a direction that's safe for them and you.
Okay. An email here from Carl. How much of an impact is the brain worm from deer reducing the moose herd compared to winter tick? And will the brain worm extirpate moose as it did to the reintroduced woodland caribou in 1963 and 1993?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. So what he's talking about, brain worm, it's called meningeal worm. It's one of those parasites that deer carry but don't seem to be harmed by. But when the moose picks up a few worms, and it does this by inadvertently, when it's browsing on vegetation, it'll pick up a slug or a snail that carries this parasite in its larval stage. So it doesn't know it's doing this. And this life cycle continues in the moose, and it becomes a worm that migrates through the central nervous system, oftentimes winding up in its brain. So you can imagine what that worm does is it can cause paralysis. It can cause confusion in the moose, and sometimes it can lead to the moose's death. But to answer his question, the winter tick is a far more prevalent and bigger pressure on the moose population. It's really driving the moose population in Maine today. We see brain worm in some young animals and in some adults in a given year. When they show up along the roadside and they start going in circles in one direction or have a tilted head, it gets people's attention very quickly, and we respond to that and try to figure out what's going on. But I would say at this point that the adult survival rate of moose in Maine is very high. And so if meningeal worm was more of a problem for us, you would see that in reduced survival rates of adults. But he's absolutely correct that if you have a lot of deer together in one area and a lot of moose in one area together, the moose are going to lose out, and it's going to reduce that population eventually. So that's the struggle in Maine, is that northern Maine, the deer population has increased, but if it increases like it does in southern Maine, that can be and may be a problem decades from now.
Mm. An email here from Rob. The moose is an iconic species. We should do everything within our power to preserve this species, including limiting hunting that complies with data-based research. I hope there's more research that will address this issue, especially when it comes to climate change. So limiting hunting, though, Lee, it seems counterintuitive, but you don't think that this is the answer.
No, I think it's not the answer at all. And I know it's hard for people to understand or digest, but if you look at the moose population in Maine, and believe me, we spend hours doing this all the time, the hunting mortality, the number of animals that are harvested every year, does not impact that population, whether it's going up or down at this point, because our hunting has been conservative relative to the number of moose that are out there. What's driving the population, again, is winter tick depressing productivity in cows. We don't birth as many calves every year as we used to back in the 1980s when moose were recolonizing the state. And then the mortality of these young animals from winter tick, over winter mortality, that is the driver. Again, adults' survival rates are very high, and they live to reproduce for many, many years. And the hunting mortality is a really small piece of the pie when you look at all causes of mortality during a given year.
We'll go to Peter calling from Buxton. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Well, greetings. I'm glad you're working on this wildlife population dilemma. I have experience as a student at the University of Michigan, first with the deer population when it was overpopulated. And you know, the need to get in there, count the deer, then get in the sharpshooters and bring the population down to something that isn't going to ruin the environment. But also just knowing about the work of moose on Isle Royale out in Lake Superior, where they were getting very overpopulated, and they introduced the natural predator, the timber wolf. And understanding is that there was an improvement in the population's health, general health. Speak about, of course, in southern Maine, where it would be much more not very pragmatic to introduce timber wolf, but northern Maine, it might be reasonable to have more of that kind of natural predation that would thin out where it's obviously a problem.
Yeah, Peter, thank you for your call. Lee, has that been suggested? Have you thought about it?
Well, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it except from, the biological point of view, because, the idea of wolf reintroduction is just a social landmine, basically. But, I would make the comment, I work with other moose biologists across North America and Canada and the United States and all that. And, the thing is that, you have something like wolves that don't just eat the sick and the weak and the calves and everything. So there's a thing in wildlife called additive mortality. And so I think, something like wolves would add on to the pile that already exists with something like the winter tick. So it something like that could really drive the population down and be very problematic. Not to mention the fact that as big as the North Main Woods is, how do I say this? I mean, it's not going to contain any animal, right? I mean, animals move across the landscape into other states, other provinces, et cetera, et cetera. So it just creates a lot of complication, I would say.
Peter, thanks for your question. Let's see. We'll go to Robin calling from Bath. Hi, Robin. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering why when you have those baby moose and you're tagging them, you couldn't give them some kind of preventative medicine like we give our domestic animals to prevent or kill the ticks and fleas?
Well, on one hand, you probably could, but, we capture over time 70 animals and, treating them with some kind of acaricide that kills ticks, while it might work, would have no impact on the population of ticks out there. It wouldn't do anything to decrease tick abundance. And the whole point of putting GPS collars on these animals is to understand what their mortality rates are, what the cause of death is, so that we can have the conversation we're having today with certainty that this is what drives moose in the state of Maine, which is these loss of calves. So if you went out there and you were just trying to inoculate them and doctor them, it would be a different, it would be a whole different thing than trying to do research to understand the complexities of this winter tick problem that we have.
Robin, thank you for your question. We will go to Shannon calling from Township 32 in Hancock County. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. No, I'm not calling with a question. I'm calling because we've been out here in Township 32 for 52 years, and we are very aware of where we live, and we watch everything around us, and I record a lot of it. And the moose, when we first came out here in the 70s and the 80s, we saw a lot more deer than we did moose. And then at some point, we didn't hardly ever see deer. We have 350 acres of woodland, blueberry land. It's a beautiful place. And they, at some point, the deer really slowed down, but we started seeing a lot of moose. And they would come very close to us. We don't have a big presence here. We don't have big lights or anything. So we had moose coming through our garden, walking down the driveway to the cabin, whatever. I even had an interaction on the Studmill Road with a grown moose that was standing on the side of the road with two people with a truck that I knew were actually notorious poachers. And this moose was just standing there with them. And I stopped, and I had come back from getting groceries, and this moose was so tame that I was able to take apples out of my grocery bag and feed an apple to this moose. And when I got home, I called my friend Dave Priest, who was a game warden at the time, and he said, "Oh yeah, that's got the meningeal worm." And that's never happened again, but it was interesting because the moose wasn't that far into that disease. So he was just friendly and he let me feed him an apple. But whatever. My point of calling is that what we're seeing now is we occasionally see an adult moose. We have a one-lane dirt road in from the Studmill Road. And occasionally when you're coming and going in the winter, you get one running in front of you until he gets to a place where he goes off the road. We see tracks across our blueberry land all the time. They haven't really been coming in as close or being as frequent as they used to be. And we've never seen a yearling, which is what he's talking about, that mostly get attacked.
dead anywhere. We've never, you know, coming and going. I mean, we're out here 12 months out of the year. We've never seen a dead moose covered with deer, with winter ticks, you know.
Oh, well, that's great.
Well, it is, but I guess what I'm calling about is how can I let somebody know what we're seeing here over a 50-year period? We don't have any internet access at all. We do have a cell phone, and I just never know, you know, if we saw something unusual or whatever, how to contact somebody. We had some people from the fish and game place, like they are about turkeys. They came out here and they trapped turkeys and, you know, all that stuff, but I sometimes just wish I had a phone number that if there was an unusual moose situation out here, which we really just, you know, the last 5 to 6 years,
sure,
there hasn't been that many moose things here. But when it is, it's incredible. One time they showed up at my right in front of the house with the garden, and one had a rope. It was two. It was siblings. And one had the male had a rope, blue rope wrapped around his antlers, and we couldn't figure it out. And then we remembered we have a gate coming into our farm, and then at the top of the road that comes over here, we, in case we're working in the field, we have it. And we always had a rope that we would put across the road saying we're in the west field. And this moose that showed up right in front of the house had gone up to the post that blue rope, we realized it was a blue rope, that he had gone up there with his antlers and caught that blue rope, and it didn't seem to be bothering him any, and him and his sister wandered off. But we just see them
quite often,
but not as much as we used to. And like I said, the fact that we've never found a dead calf, I'm glad, because it's not fun. We found
I'm glad too. Well, I'll ask Lee your question then. Lee, if Shannon sees something unusual, do you want to know about it?
Absolutely. You can always call the Jonesboro office. That's the regional office down east. You can call State Patrol and they can get a hold of a game warden. And usually when a moose issue comes up, it gets referred to me as well. So there are you can grab your cell phone and we can get you a number there as well. And not seeing dead moose, we hear that a lot. That's why we put GPS collars on these animals, right? Is that when we have 70 animals collared and the collar is sitting still for 6 hours, it sends out a text and an email to me. And then I determine that that's likely a mortality. And then by truck and snowmobile and snowshoe, I go out and recover that animal and do a necropsy. And that's where we get our results from.
Yeah. And generally speaking, Shannon mentioned she's lived in the same place for 52 years. Are citizen observers helpful to you?
Yeah, they are. I mean, we're always interested in knowing what people who've been around are seeing and hearing. And it's always good to talk to people.
All right. Well, Shannon, thank you for your call. We do need to take another quick break. We're talking about moose on Maine Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning all about Maine's signature megafauna, the moose. Maine's moose biologist, Lee Cantor, is with me today to talk about this magnificent animal. And we are listening to your comments and questions. You can send a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. Lee, earlier in the program, I asked you what somebody ought to do if they encounter a moose, say when they're hiking or boating or something like that. What about on the road? What are some tips for drivers approaching moose? And not just tourists. A lot of people in southern Maine maybe have never encountered a moose on the road until they go a traveling.
Yeah, it's a tough one because it's, you know, it's expecting the unexpected. And certainly with moose, you know, we're always concerned about low light conditions, right? So early in the morning, just before sunset are times where moose tend to be very active. And of course, unlike deer, they're very dark in color. They're very tall. You don't see the eye shine with moose. So I think it's one of those things where if you are traveling in some areas that are known to have moose and you see moose signs, et cetera, it's just good to not travel beyond what you can see with your headlights and to slow down a bit. And, you know, oftentimes moose tend to stay next to the road sometimes in the springtime. late spring, early summer. They're in mineral seeps or salt licks, you know, swampy little places like that. And usually they stay put. But, you know, as soon as I ever said that to somebody that I haven't seen a moose come running across the road, then it happened to me. So I've had that happen several times in the North Main Woods where out of the blue, a moose comes running across the road, and it's quite a surprise. So I think it's being aware and knowing that those times are the most critical to be aware of moose.
Okay, a whole bunch of suggestions coming in to help you deal with the tick population. Yes. From Ellen, couldn't a salt mineral lick be developed with systemic tick medicine to lessen the tick population?
Possibly. I'm not a chemist or know about this, but I will tell you this, is that unlike deer, so in Maine, people feed deer quite a bit, and people put out licks for deer and other animals, and deer congregate in masses. It's like they have each other's email address or something. I don't know, but the word goes out, and you go from feeding two deer to feeding 200 before you can bat an eyelash. Moose do not exist like that, and they do not... sorry, my phone there, but crazy. I never get a phone call on my landline. But anyways, it's just something that we've tried in our early part of our research when we were catching moose by helicopter. We needed to figure out some ways to catch moose by our own hands with the department. And we can do things that other people can't do, like we'd use spotlights at night and dart these moose, etc. We tried every kind of salt lick to tempt moose in, and it just did not work. And of course, we're always looking for solutions. You know, we work for the state. We want to spend our money wisely, and we want to be able to do things that we could say to you, Jennifer, this is 100%. It's going to be successful. And if we cannot provide that measure of success, then it's just not something we can spend money doing.
An email from David, could moose be protected from winter ticks with medication delivered by paintball? It seems it could be a fun sport. Oh, ivermectin geez. Is inexpensive, and paint added to the medication could prevent overdose concerns. No. Now, I'm guessing you're just going to say that, you know, with the numbers are just so giant.
So those are great ideas. And again, we've had this happen many, many times. I've darted moose from the roadside. As part of our research, and you know, we try to do this in ways that are feasible, that are going to work. And I can tell you one thing: when we spend many nights cruising roads trying to dart cows and calves, the cow is very protective of the calf. You can't get close enough. You know, you incur so much when you capture an animal. You're responsible for the health and well-being of that animal, and it's just. It's not a feasible thing. And believe me, when people ask me and tell me about solutions for ticks, I do not blow those things off. This is what I do for a job, 12 months of a year. I've been doing this for 21 years. I take people very seriously when they want to offer suggestions. And I appreciate it because it shows the compassion and passion people have for moose and for winter ticks and trying to find a solution. So I'm not just showing disagreement. I'm telling you that as a government employee and as a biologist that studies moose all the time, it's imperative that I have a solution that makes sense and that's plausible. And we've learned from our friends in Quebec about treating moose, but a lot of this falls back to the scope and scale when you're dealing with 10 million acres, tens of thousands of moose in areas that can be very challenging to get to. And you got to think about the time of year to apply this. And can you apply something over and over again? And it becomes quite an obstacle and very, very big challenge.
We'll go to Jeff, who's calling from near Fort Kent. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. I graduated with a degree in wildlife biology from Virginia Tech back in 1999, and I currently live off-grid outside of Fort Kent. And my question was, not thinking that Maine would actually adopt this, but I'm a private landowner, so I wonder, has there been any scientific literature done on the effects of prescribed burns on tick populations and being able to break the cycle?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for decades. There's a well-known moose biologist in Alberta who put out a book called White as a Ghost, and it's full of puns about moose and ticks, and so it's very readable. But it's an incredible amount of knowledge about moose and ticks and what to do about ticks. And prescribed burns have always been something that makes a lot of sense when done in the right season and done hot enough that it could burn the duff layer and kill either egg masses or larvae. The problem is in the state of Maine, and my understanding working with the forestry folks, is that trying to build a fire and burn is very difficult. And several years ago, they did a prescribed burn on 10 acres that went pretty well. It was a pretty huge effort from a resource standpoint to pull something like that off, and took a lot of resources, et cetera, et cetera. The end all be all is 10 acres is meaningless to a moose, right? And so, you know, prescribed burns, you know, would have to be done over a huge, huge amount of area. And again, I know Jeff was saying, you know, on private lands, and yeah, that would be a great place to start as a private landowner who understands all this and the complexity of this and would pull something off and be interested. That would be maybe a good thing if it could work.
Jeff, thanks for your call.
On a larger landscape, a challenge. Yeah.
Chuck calling from Orland. Hi, Chuck. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering what Lee has learned. Do they get a chance to go to Europe or talk to European scientists about what they're doing? And, you know, he's been doing this for 21 years. What's one of the really interesting things about moose that you've learned over the years? I know there's probably a lot, but I'm just interested. Thanks.
Well, I was fortunate enough last year to go to the International Moose Conference in Sweden. And the Swedes have been hunting and managing moose for a lot longer than us, way, way longer than us. And they have a very interesting and intriguing system that I could probably spend the day talking about. But, you know, the thing about the Swedes out there is that it shows you how much culturally things are embedded, right? So they have a hunting culture that's very different than Maine, very different than the U.S. It emanates from the private landowners and how they hunt. I can't even explain it, but I was just fascinated by it. And it hit home much more by being out there physically and seeing the landscape. They harvest, in 1 year, they harvested over 100,000 moose, more than all moose harvest in the entire world. And I said that right, the entire world. And, you know, it's just a very different system, very different tradition than us, and just very eye-opening when you look at that. They don't have winter tick, so they don't have to deal with that. That tends to be a North American problem that we're facing. And of all the jurisdictions, both in Canada and the United States that deal with winter tick, there is currently no solution that's plausible for dealing with winter ticks. And many of us are working on it.
Chuck, thank you so much for your call. Let's see, we'll go to somebody else calling from Fort Kent, Joanne. Hi, Joanne, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer, thank you. I am a landowner on about 100 acres here in Fort Kent since about 1973, and I understand from the state biologist in Augusta that turkeys have been very helpful in eating ticks. However, there aren't that many turkeys around, although they are increasing in numbers. I'm just wondering about opossums. I understand they are very good, efficient tick eaters, and I wonder if they would be happy living in this climate.
Yeah, it's you're correct. I mean, turkeys, if you've ever followed a turkey, not that many people probably do, they're incredible with their vision, and they like to pick off little things and eat them, and ticks are on that menu as well. Possums, again, they're also excellent as well. Those species are both moving northward. I live outside of Bangor. I had a possum in my yard last year. It's not the most northerly observation of a possum, but it's all changing. And, you know, there's pluses and minuses to all that. I mean, those animals are moving northward because the limiting factor, as you know, living in Fort Kent, is winter. And so, you know, when winter gets more mild, they're able to expand further north.
Joanne, thanks for your call. And it's our last question for the day. Thank you, Lee, for joining us for the hour. Lee Cantor is our state moose biologist with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, transportation in Maine. What are the biggest challenges and possible solutions? There's a new coalition trying to come up with some answers. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.